think that the whole universe was made of electrons, protons, and neutrons. Which protons and neutrons are what you got in the nucleus, held together with, I guess it's the strong force, and you have this cloud of electrons going around it. Well, the protons and neutrons are now made up of six different kinds of quarks. And I think, and the quarks themselves are probably made up of subparticles yet. You could say you have solar systems inside of solar systems inside of solar systems. And we're starting to look at the finer and finer details of what matter is really made out of. And that's why it takes more and more energy. You could say using a bigger and bigger hammer to smash your rock into smaller and smaller particles, and you're putting the results under a bigger and bigger microscope in order to find out what really was there. That's my metaphorical way of looking at what that great big, bigger than a building detector array is doing with this machine that has the most amount of electron volts that we've ever created in a repetitive experiment. When you bring two beams together, you have a huge probability of intercept problem. You may think that the beam that's going around clockwise, you have focused it right down to a millimeter or a micrometer in diameter. You focus the beam that well. And you've done the same thing with the beam going around counterclockwise. Therefore, you think the beams are going to hit each other head on. Nice sounding theory. When you get down to the microscopic level, and you're talking about 10 to the minus 31 meters of radius of a molecule, a hydrogen molecule, or a helium molecule, I think it's got something like a Fermi, I believe it's called, 10 to the minus 31 meter of radius. Damn small. So even though you focus your beam as tight as you can, the majority of those particles going to the right and particles going to the left will miss each other or just create a glancing blow. Very few of them are going to have a head-on decision that really do, head-on collision, that really do the destruction we're looking for in order to really take everything apart and light up your detector, so to speak. So you have to use millions and billions of experiments to find the experiment where you were lucky enough to get two head-on collisions, where one bullet head-on hit the other bullet head-on, so to speak, and you got the real good smash, and you got the real good break up the particles, and your detector hopefully caught everything of that event. So you have to do these experiments a large number of times, sift through thousands and thousands of pictures, millions of pictures that come out of your detector assembly. You have set up some huge computer programs to study millions of consecutive pictures over the next hour and find that picture that's got the golden bullet that hit the other golden bullet, so to speak, and gave you the event you're looking for. That's part of what's going on here. Huge probability of intercept problem, because you can never focus the beam fine enough. No matter how good your magnet is, no matter how good you are at the focusing, you're focusing objects that are moving around the circular ring. They don't want to be in a circle. You've got these huge magnets trying to keep them into the circle, and the individual particles all have, in the case of protons, positive charge. They're resisting, they're repelling each other at the same time you're trying to focus them. So it's quite a battle going on here for that focusing event in order to create the collision. Maybe that's part of, I'm not sure if you asked that question, but I felt like saying it. Back to you, Fred. KC2OES, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good. That made you answer the question, basically. I have another news flash here, though, I'm just reading right now. Hackers almost broke into the computers. They were moments, one step away from breaking into the control computer, according to the news report.
Okay. Great subject, but you didn't, I mean, you took off the blindfold, and I haven't yet figured out that I'm in the middle of the Taj Mahal. Okay. Somebody hacked into a computer somewhere. When? Where? Back to you, Fred.
Apparently it was the control computer for the Large Hadron Collider. This is the news report.
And was that hacking process anything to do with the quenching of the magnet, or did it happen to be two nearby events that were coincidental? Back to you, Fred.
I'll unkey after I ask this question and let you decide. It's about a three paragraph, maybe nine lines of news report.
That news report was just flashed across I don't think any of our local stations have 9:30 news, so what website were you watching to get that news report? Go ahead.
Well, it's dated September 12th, but they say they almost broke into the computer at the Hadron site.
Doesn't sound like they had a very good firewall. Okay, Paul had a further discussion or question. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, one question and two comments. One comment is one of the things that they like to find with this is the what they call the Higgs boson particle. Theoretical particle they feel had to exist in the first, I think, 3 nanoseconds after the Big Bang. And that's what they want to find. That's number one goal. And that's what they refer to as the God particle. So they feel this stuff had to exist there. And they think that maybe this eventually became the quark, the lepton, all the different hundreds and hundreds of, I don't know how many hundreds of sub-particles that they have now. Like you said before, Dick, you went down to the protons and the quarks and the gluons and the muons, and it just goes on and on. And now all of these things have exact partner supersymmetry, I think they call it, where that's the other thing that they're looking for with this experimental machine that they built. They're trying to find theoretically that supersymmetry should exist, which would prove other dimensions that they're looking for and all. So they'll have a ball once they get this thing running. My real question had to do with the gold particles out of Brookhaven that they use. I don't know if they ever use anything else but the gold protons that go around out there in Long Island. And I don't know what particles they use out in Geneva, but you know, they're protons, you know, also. They have to strip these protons from the electrons. I'm wondering how they go about doing that before they, you know, they accelerated, you know, up to tremendous speeds without their electron components, you know, gold. I don't know how many electrons. They've got to get rid of all these electrons, hundreds of electrons, before they, trillions of protons start shooting around the 17-mile ring. I wonder how that all starts, that maybe, you know. Speed of light, that was my other curiosity. When these particles are accelerating to close to or near the speed of light, I mean, the other particles also accelerating close to the speed of light. This is what these people have to think about. Not only is the mass from our point of view increasing, if you're on a particle, you're sitting on that proton and you're going around, you know, as far as you're concerned, the mass is increasing, but from our perspective, it is, that's happening, there's so much energy going into it. Curiosity about it is that one's going at the speed of light, the other one is going at the speed of light, and that means it's coming at you, and you can't exceed the speed of light. That means time must be changing for the two protons when they're approaching before they hit. So there must be some timing involved here with this, that they have to think about before they put this machine into operation. Before somebody said, let's spend, you know, $10 billion, they have to have all this worked out. I find that totally amazing. Back to you, Dick. WS2KY.
Okay, good question. I've got a bunch of speculations of an answer, but Mel's going to straighten this all out first. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. My ears perked up when you said about the Higgs boson, you know, and I sat in on a nice discussion in the city in college about a year ago. I mean, I really didn't understand this, the physics that much, because this is pretty heavy stuff, but from what I got from it, that there were 6 important particles in the nucleus that we call quarks, and that is the up and they were actually into 3 groups, these quarks. We have up quark and down quark. Then we had charm quartz and strange quartz. And then we had top quartz, and then we have bottom quartz. And putting all this stuff together, because that's what I stuck in my mind, the Higgs boson, if it can be found, as if it's supposed to be, why matter has mass, and what actually produces gravity. Now, is that what the final destiny of these experiments that are over?
I think that's one way of looking at it, but I guarantee an optimistic guy would say it's a lot more than that. Let me zoom way back here and slowly zoom into it from my point of view. From my point of view, and I'm not alone on this one, all progress that we have ever made is because somebody was curious. What is Mother Nature doing? How did all this happen? It takes curiosity for you to start investigating anything. And so way back in the early days, a guy named Franklin said, gee, I think lightning might be this thing called electricity. And he supposedly did an experiment with a kite to confirm that lightning was electricity and it would make a spark. And what is that spark is an interesting question. I've done a bunch of high voltage experiments in the last year because of a particular project I was involved in. And I've learned an awful lot about what is ionization. It turns out that the question that Paul is asking, how do you strip those electrons away from the protons? You've got a molecule. Let's assume now that I've got a hydrogen molecule in front of me. By some means, I've managed to isolate one single hydrogen molecule. It consists of, if it's an ordinary hydrogen molecule, not a deuterium or a tritium, it's a molecule with one proton in the center and one electron going around it. That's the simplest molecule we know about. And if I did something called ionization, which I'll explain in a second, I can separate the electron and push that over to the right, separate the proton from the electron, push the proton to the left and the electron to the right. And the proton that I collected to the left, I can put it into a particle accelerator inside of my vacuum ring and accelerate the proton. And the electrons, I could accelerate those in another kind of accelerator if I wanted to. What is ionization? Well, every spark of those spark plugs in your car is an ionization process. If I had two round spheres, and there's a reason I use round as opposed to pointy ones, because I have more control of the local electrostatic field when I have two round spheres. I've got two round spheres separated by 1 centimeter, and I start putting positive voltage on the right-hand sphere and negative voltage on the left-hand sphere. And these spheres are each being supported by a rod that goes over to my power supply. I got a rod going to the right, holding the right-hand sphere, and I got the left-hand sphere with a rod going over to the left, and those rods curve around, come back to my power supply, and I'm turning the knob on the power supply. And I start off at 1,000 volts, nothing happens. 10,000 volts, nothing happens. 20,000 volts, nothing happens. I get up to 30,000 volts. All of a sudden, a spark occurs between those two spheres, because air has a so-called dielectric strength of roughly 30,000 volts per centimeter, which is around 76,000 volts per inch. All right, so when I exceed that amount of local electrostatic field, 30,000 volts across each centimeter, air will arc over in general. Why does air arc over? Okay, you've got a bunch of air molecules near that left-hand sphere. Zillions of times per second, a cosmic ray comes along and strikes one of those air molecules, ionizes that air molecule, strikes it at a high velocity. That's what a cosmic ray is. It's a particle moving at very fast velocity, comes along, strikes that air molecule, separates the electron from the proton of that air molecule, separates the nucleus from the electron cloud. The electrons that were near that negative lead of the left-hand sphere is negative. Because the electron is now free, that's what ionization means. I've separated the cloud of electrons from the nucleus, or at least some of those electrons, with partial ionization. that electron is being repulsed by the negative charge that's on the left-hand sphere, and says, I don't want to be there. He starts pushing his way toward the positive sphere on the right-hand side. He's attracted to that positive charge because he's a negative charge, that particular electron. And he starts moving as fast as he can. And depending on how many volts there is, that's that electron volts again, we talk about the velocity he's going to get. If it was in a vacuum, that electron, if I knew the number of volts, and I knew the distance between the two, I'd only have to know the distance. All I have to do is the number of volts, and in that particular experiment, I would have 30,000 electron volts of acceleration of that single electron if it was in a vacuum. And you wouldn't see anything happening. But because it's in air, at 30,000 volts per centimeter, that electron gets the opportunity to move fast enough before he strikes the next air molecule. Now, when he finally strikes that next air molecule, he's got enough kinetic energy to ionize the next air molecule. And he begins an avalanche process. The electrons that he breaks loose start moving fast enough that they strike the next air molecule and ionize those. That's the avalanche. If I had 25,000 volts instead of 30,000 volts across the centimeter gap, that electron accelerates, doesn't get enough energy on average to move fast enough that when he strikes the next air molecule, he does not ionize it. Therefore, you don't get the avalanche that you and I call an arc. That spark plug in your car and this experiment that I'm describing of these two spheres a centimeter apart, that's what ionization is. You create this one method of doing ionization. Create a strong enough E field in air, and you will arc over the air, and you'll see that as a spark. Very dramatic thing to look at. If I start doing the experiment in a partial vacuum, if, for instance, I do the experiment at an amount of vacuum that equals 30,000 feet, I don't need 30 kilovolts anymore. I could probably do it with 5 kilovolts. The curve of atmospheric pressure versus the number of volts required is called the Passion curve. A guy named Passion, way back in 1750-something or other, ran a bunch of experiments like this to find out at various amounts of vacuum, where does air break down? Why at partial vacuum, when there's less air molecules there, does the air break down more easily? Opposite of common sense, until you figure out what's going on microscopically. If I've got air at a lower atmospheric pressure, that's a fancy way of saying there's less air molecules there. I'm not compressing them as much. The spacing between them, on average, is greater. Therefore, that electron that got broken loose by that cosmic ray that came along gets a bigger opportunity to accelerate. He's got to accelerate through a longer distance before he finally strikes another air molecule. Therefore, he gets a chance to build up a bigger velocity. He strikes the next air molecule with more kinetic energy, and he ionizes it. That's the reason why greater spacing between the molecules, lower air pressure, requires less voltage to do an arc over. If you and I were designing a high voltage power supply for a traveling wave tube that's going to be used in your airplane for a high voltage power transmitter, maybe a jamming transmitter, and you're going to fly the plane at 30,000 feet, you've got to do a much better job of insulating that power supply. Otherwise, on the bench, it works like a charm. You put it in the airplane, fly it at 30,000 feet, and your power supply arcs over, and your tube doesn't get a chance to do its work. So now when you go to a completely hard vacuum, like you've got in outer space, there's no longer any air molecules there. That electron that got broken loose, he flies right across over to that positive terminal, nothing in between. He's not ionizing any air molecules. He's not creating an avalanche. We don't see the spark. Unless the polarization reverses. Now you're into something called multi-factor. And we ran into this one head-on in the case of the Mercury program. They did beautiful testing of the transmitter on Mercury before they launched the capsule in space. They knew exactly how many watts they're putting into the antenna. They knew exactly what the communication range would be of the transmitter. They flew the Mercury capsule. The ground stations had a hell of a time listening to the signal. It was 15, 20 dB weaker than it was supposed to be. Why? Again, a cosmic ray in space came along, struck the copper electrode on the left-hand side of the dipole of the S-band transmitter that's in space. An electron broke loose. That electron flew from the left-hand side of the dipole to the right-hand side of the dipole while the right-hand side was positive. It struck the copper on the right-hand side and released two electrons. During the next half cycle of the radio wave, the left-hand side became positive, the right-hand side is negative, and that, so two electrons that are broke loose now flew over to the left-hand side. And so you get this cloud of electrons flying back and forth, and that's called multipactor. You have to be very careful to choose the right material of your dipole that are going to be in the vacuum of space to make sure that the electrons flying back and forth between the two don't get the opportunity to create this avalanche. The cloud of electrons flying back and forth between the halves of the dipole in the vacuum of space represented a dummy load which was sucking up the RF energy, turning it into heat, and therefore the amount of energy, you were putting the same 10 watts into the transmitter, but the poor guy down on the ground station had a 10 or 15 dB weaker signal to listen to because that cloud of electrons flying back and forth across that dipole was sucking up the energy due to this multi-factor effect, multiple impact effect. So it gives you a little bit of a feeling for what happens with ionization and why your spark plug does why it does. You'll notice on an old car I used to have that I would hear a little bit of ignition static in the automobile while I'm driving down the road. If I pressed on the accelerator to make the car go faster, the ignition noise always got louder. Why? It got louder because when I pressed on the accelerator, I'm asking for more power out of the engine. I did that by the accelerator opening up the carburetor. The carburetor put a richer mixture of fuel and air into that cylinder. The richer mixture had higher dielectric strength. Therefore, the voltage across the gap on the spark plug went higher before the spark plug finally broke down. When the spark plug finally broke down, more voltage was there, the spark was more intense, therefore the current flowing into my ignition wire was greater, therefore the ignition noise was greater. It was interesting to listen to my AM radio, listen to the ignition noise, and watch the ignition noise get louder and softer as I touch the accelerator of my automobile. I don't know if anybody has any further questions or comments on all this jazz. Looks like we're holding a miniature science quiz or whatever, science class here tonight. K2LIW listening.
Yeah, I got a question, Dick. You brought up something very interesting. This is K2KY.
Mel recognized? You got the floor, Mel.
Yeah, you mentioned hydrogen. You know, we're talking about hydrogen. Hydrogen and all is a very interesting, gas. What the heck is anti-hydrogen? This is, something else, that I heard it mentioned, but I'm not sure. Is the anti-hydrogen actually what that they talk in the science fiction of matter, anti-matter in the machine, in the drive engine, over?
Yeah. The evidence I know of right now, Mel, tells me that for every particle you know about, there is a mirror image particle, an opposite particle. We all have heard about electrons. They're tiny little particles, the smallest ones we know of, that are complete in themselves. Yeah, they're made up of subparticles called quarks. The six quarks in various combinations make electrons, photons, and neutrons. But the electron itself is a negatively charged thing. There is the positive equivalent of an electron called a positron. You do enough atom-smashing experiments of the right kinds of molecules, and occasionally you'll see evidence of a positron. The vast majority of the matter on this planet you and I know about is what you and I call positive matter. But the fact that I can find in my particle accelerator one experiment per billion of a particular kind of experiment where I will see a positively charged electron, and if I do enough experiments, I'll find a negatively charged proton and some more neutrons, it's obvious that I can take a negatively charged proton and a positively charged electron, all have different names, and I can make another kind of hydrogen molecule that, yes, you could call negative hydrogen. And what would happen if I've got these two things in space and I allow them to come together? Under normal circumstances, every molecule resists with tremendous force the electrostatic charge of the other molecule. Each molecule has a cloud of electrons flying around that nucleus. That cloud of electrons is heavily negatively charged, if you get close enough to it, inverse square law. So the negatively charged cloud on the left-hand molecule, the negatively charged cloud on the right-hand molecule, make them repel with tremendous force. Until you use a particle accelerator or something that's a really big hammer, so to speak, you can't make those two molecules come together. They just resist. However, if I could by some means make a negative kind of hydrogen molecule on the left side, which now has a cloud of positrons flying around it, positively charged particles, and I've got an ordinary hydrogen molecule to the right, and I bring them close to each other, those two clouds of electron-like things flying around the nucleuses are opposite charge. They attract real fast. They come roaring together. And so the electrons annihilate each other, the protons annihilate each other. You get a tremendous amount of gamma rays and probably some other particles. You get a tremendous amount of energy coming out of matter and antimatter coming together. So therefore, the good science fiction is predicting, and probably right, that if by some magic I can make a container of real matter and antimatter in two separate containers, squirt them under controlled conditions into my rocket nozzle, so to speak, and let them annihilate each other, I get a tremendous amount of energy out of that experiment. I could use that as a way of storing a large amount of energy on my spaceship and getting a whole lot of thrust out of it, or at least a whole lot of energy out of allowing these things to come together. Now, to take positive matter and put it into a tank and compress it and liquefy it, easy. To take antimatter and put it into a tank and compress it, by our standards, extremely hard. What are you going to make the walls of the tank out of? Because when those antimatter particles strike the walls of your tank, you're going to get that energy a lot sooner than you want, and it's going to destroy your tank and your whole darn spaceship. So you have to create some kind of very exotic force field to hold on to your antimatter to make sure it doesn't create an explosion for you prematurely in an uncontrolled manner. But if you could get a tank full of antimatter and a tank full of matter and allow them to mix slowly together in a controlled manner, boy, you got one hell of a potent engine. How about that? I hope we don't lose the timer here. Okay, Bell, I wonder if that comes close to answering your question. K2KEY, K2LIW.
WSON.
Paul, recognized. Bell first.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, I can visualize exactly what you're saying. Now, in other words, if it comes together on an uncontrolled matter, in other words, this is what we're doing. We'd be creating a hydrogen bomb, literally. I mean, this is basically, I guess, how a hydrogen bomb works by a fusion. That's the thermonuclear fusion. But why can't you hold this antimatter by a magnetic principle? In other words, by holding it maybe in a magnetic chamber so that it can't go, like you say, you know, out of control. Would this magnetic system be able to hold this negative in check and then release it slower, Dick, over?
In theory, your answer is yes. If I can create the right kind of exotic magnetic field, I can hold on to my antimatter without touching it, and therefore don't get a premature explosion. But heaven help you if you lose that magnetic field. You've got an explosion you didn't ask for. So the safety measures you'd have to add to that process would be heroic. On top of that, how strong a magnetic field can you create? How much compression of this antimatter are you going to get in order to put enough of it into the tank to do the job? Now, a hydrogen bomb really isn't matter and antimatter coming together, although the amount of energy you get out of there is somewhat similar. It turns out that My understanding of a hydrogen bomb is that you take two hydrogen molecules and force them together into H2, that the energy of the H2 molecule is a lot lower than the energy of a single pair of hydrogen molecules that are separated. And so in the process of bringing them together, a whole lot of energy is being released. That's a very rough approximation of what I think is going on there. And that's nuclear fusion. In the case of nuclear fission, you're taking uranium molecules, breaking them apart, and in the process of breaking them apart, you end up with resultant matter, which again has a lower energy state. And therefore, that energy conversion is the heat that's coming out of that nuclear fission bomb. The way the sun works is it's taking hydrogen molecules, putting them under something like 10 million degrees Fahrenheit of temperature, and something like 10 million atmospheres of pressure. All of that's taking place in the center of the sun, and you're pushing those hydrogen molecules together, making helium molecules. It's a multi-step process, but the beginning of the process is hydrogen molecules, the end of the process is helium molecules. The helium molecules are at a lower energy state, and therefore a tremendous amount of heat is given off, and you and I call that sunshine. Now, the helium molecules get pushed together, and they make something else. So what the sun is doing right now is it's taking its hydrogen and generating helium. Eventually, it's going to take the helium and make lithium, and the lithium and make carbon. It's going to climb the periodic table. But there's a catch. When it gets to iron, the next process up the table of bringing iron molecules together is not a positive energy process. It's a negative energy process. And so this is one of the methods by which a star goes supernova. It no longer can generate enough heat in the center to create enough expansion to hold up all of the stuff. See, the sun is operating under what's called the Leidenfrost effect. In other words, you've got a whole lot of matter in the sun with a whole lot of gravity, and it wants to come together at a point. But it's not allowed to do that because there's so much heat in the center pushing the stuff back out. If the sun became bigger because you and I just dumped a whole lot of matter into it, the pressure in the center would increase, the temperature in the center would increase, therefore the amount of conversion of hydrogen to helium would increase, therefore the temperature would increase again, and that would create expansion, which pushes the matter back out. And it's slow. It would be a hotter sun, but it wouldn't be a sun that goes into a supernova explosion. But once the process of climbing the periodic table comes to iron, and there's no longer any heat being generated in the center, you do get the collapse. And that collapse, the bounce, and the stuff flying back out of there, we call that a supernova. It's a certain kind of supernova. So it gives you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on with fusion. The sun is operating by fusion, a real high energy process. But to do that with a, what is it called now? Inertial confinement procedure or a tokamak device to try to create a strong enough magnetic field in the tokamak where you can create this 10 million degrees Fahrenheit, 10 million or the centigrade, and 10 million atmospheres to try to force the materials together without touching the walls of the tokamak, which would melt it immediately. To create a magnetic field strong enough to do that is an extremely difficult problem. When you've got something as big as the sun operating by gravity, it does it very nicely. And it's not easy to contain that sun in the back of your automobile as the engine. So we're trying to do these tokamak or inertial confinement things, neither of which have been thoroughly successful yet. Fairly difficult process. WS2N, KQLIW.
Yeah, I want to be up.
Okay, check out. See if I have it here. Yeah, okay, I just want to make one comment about the positron. I know they're in use in examining equipment in hospitals. It's called PET machine, P-E-T. fancy form of CAT machines, but not like the MRIs, but some kind of detecting machines for people, the positive sign. I'm not even sure what it stands for, I forgot. But I know they utilize it when there's an office. It automatically gives off electrons and positrons, and they somehow utilize the positron process for detecting things. So, I know very little about it, but I'm reading a couple of articles dealing with that topic. But they do use it. It's got a useful purpose going back quite a few decades, maybe to the 80s. I think it's been in hospitals that. Turn it back to
you, WN. Yeah, I'm going to partially answer your question and turn it over to Mel. PET stands for positron emission tomography. Tomography is a computer-generated process that makes you a three-dimensional picture of hopefully a non-invasive picture of what's going on inside the body. And the positron emission is done by they put you on a stress machine, a machine where you walk on it, and it causes your heart to beat fast, causes the muscles to work hard. They squirt this nuclear material into your bloodstream. The nuclear material, it's got something that your body will metabolize. The muscle of your heart is doing a lot of hard work at that time, so it's gathering the material. And so after you've been on the stress machine for a long enough period of time and they've squirted enough of the stuff into your body, and the muscle has now absorbed the stuff, they then put you on a flat table. And by the way, I went through this process just last week. They put you on a flat table, and they put this great big detecting machine over you, and they move the focal plane array of the detecting machine in 64 different positions, and they take a picture, so to speak. And when they take the picture from 64 different angles around the planet, eventually that picture, when you put it all together, shows a three-dimensional picture of your heart, shows where the muscle absorbed the material, and therefore, if a portion of your heart didn't absorb the material, they know ahead of time that that part of the heart is not getting enough blood flow because you've got a coronary infarction of some kind, and therefore they know that you've got some kind of a heart disease, so to speak. Let me turn it over to Mel. And by the way, I'll explain on the next transmission why it's called PET. Now, I think so. To continue with what I was saying earlier, we're talking about nuclear fusion. We're talking about one of the things you can have a lot of fun. A little bit off to one side, you can have a lot of fun with your friends that you think are good chemistry enthusiasts. Is to ask them a very simple sounding question: what is temperature? And you ask the guy, I want you to tell me what temperature is, but I don't want you to use the word centigrade, Fahrenheit, Kelvin. I don't want you to use the word hot. I don't want you to use the word cold. I want you to tell me what is temperature. You'd be amazed how many people who you think are scientifically oriented have trouble answering that question. And what it really is average kinetic energy of the molecules. If I've got a little container of air and it's sitting at 0 degrees Fahrenheit, and I've got another container of air sitting at 100 degrees Fahrenheit, what's the difference? Same number of air molecules are in there, in the exact same size container. By the rules of PV equals NRT, you'll find that the container with 100 degree Fahrenheit air is at a higher pressure. But the same number of molecules are there. Why should I get more pressure on the walls of the container? Well, higher temperature really means higher kinetic energy. In the case of air molecules, it means how fast are they moving? The higher temperature air molecules are moving faster. And at a certain rate, they're all striking the walls of the container. If they strike the walls of the container at a higher velocity, you sense more pressure. That's why that equation works that way. That's why you take the same volume of air in the same volume of container, same magnitude of air molecules in the same volume of container, simply put a blowtorch on the container to heat it up, and watch your pressure gauge connected to that container climb, because the air molecules are striking the walls at a higher velocity. Your next question is, okay, I'm not going to heat it up with a blowtorch. I'm simply going to decrease the volume of the container. That's what's going on at the bottom of your bicycle pump. The plunger on your bicycle pump is pushing the air into a smaller volume, and when it does that, the air gets hotter. When the air molecule does strike your plunger, which is moving toward the air molecule bounces off the plunger, moves with a higher velocity, just like the ping pong paddle did for you, so to speak, and therefore the air molecule, after it strikes the plunger that is moving toward it, compressing it, it is moving faster, and the faster air molecule, you and I call it hotter. And the nice thing about these air molecules bouncing around inside of a container is that they never touch the walls of the container, they never touch each other, therefore whatever temperature they're at, they stay there. These are completely elastic collisions. That's part of the magic of this, that heat is really a certain rate of, quote, emitted heat from something that's hot, is the rate at which photons are coming out of there. You can take a chunk of steel, put it in front of your blowtorch, as it gets hotter and hotter, it glows a dull red at first, a bright red later, yellow, white, blue, and so on. So not only the frequency of the photons coming out of there, but the magnitude of them is a function of temperature. Temperature to the fourth power tells you the total amount of energy coming out of something once you know its temperature. But temperature really is kinetic energy of the molecules. In the case of air molecules, it tells you how fast the air molecules are moving. In the case of a solid material, like a chunk of steel, the molecules are locked into a matrix. They keep the same general position, but they shake in place. And how violently they shake in place is now the temperature. And if they shake violently enough, they give off an amount of energy that you and I call it the red glow of the steel, that when it gets hot enough. And yes, that temperature is photon, and that's the way emission takes place. In fact, from one point of view, our transmitter, the one you're listening to right now, is emitting photons, little bundles of energy, at the rate of 144 megacycles is the cyclic rate of those photons coming off my antenna. Exaggerating things a little bit. KQKEY, I know you had more to your question. KQLIW.
Yeah, that's what I was getting towards. Okay, that's what I was going to say. That photons actually are, we never think of RF energy being radiated from a transmitter antenna as the actually photon. But that's what it is. It follows that the radio waves of lower frequency photons being generated by an alternating electron current striking atoms into an antenna wire. Basically, I would say that's a description of a transmitter. Would I be correct, over?
Striking is something that takes place in a hard vacuum when you have multi-factor. In the case of your and my dipole or Yagi that we're using right now, in my case, the electrons are not striking anything. The electrons on each half cycle are flowing from the left-hand side of my dipole to the right-hand side of the dipole on the first half cycle and then back on the driven element of my Yagi. As those electrons flow from the left side to the right side, current is created. As the current is created, it creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field is the thing that we're radiating into space, and that's the real wave. The magnetic field coming off the dipole is the thing that eventually becomes, when it straightens itself out after it gets far enough away from my dipole, it becomes the TEM wave, transverse electromagnetic wave. The hard thing to believe is that a TEM wave traveling through a hard vacuum of space really is a group of photons, little bundles of energy. Not one single electron left that antenna on the moon when I listened to the Apollo 15 astronauts in 1971. The electrons flowing in their antenna created a local magnetic field. The dish focused it and aimed it at the Earth. And I had one of the antennas on the Earth that picked up that signal at 2287.5 megahertz, S-band. And so, it's not electrons striking, it's electrons flowing, displacement current, creating the magnetic field that gets radiated. And you could, if you want, talk about the photon. Now, one of the experiments a mental experiment that Dr. Tom Williams, the B1 MBA, Mike Bravo Alpha, and I did one day, is to say, okay, we've got these digital signal programs, we've got these methods of using coded pulse code modulation. If I use a gray code or a gold code of long enough repetitiveness to it, and I transmit with my code a digital compressed signal, and I do it for a long enough period of time at an extremely slow data rate, so that I can listen to a weaker and weaker signal. I'm narrowing up the noise equivalent bandwidth of my receiver by using a very long pseudo-random code. I'm generating the pseudo-random code locally. I'm looking at the pseudo-random code that's coming to me from space. I correlate the two, between the two, maybe for an hour period of time, to find out where the correlation was, and I eventually get that message very, very slowly. I'm using a lot of digital signal processing, post-detection processing, to process a weaker and weaker signal. So Tom and I said, hey, can I take a milliwatt transmitter into a dipole with just the right, very long pseudo-random code? Can my milliwatt transmitter into a dipole do moon bounce, talking to another dipole in some other place on the Earth? And the answer we came up with, yes. We talked about how big the code would be in order to have a dipole talk to a dipole with moon bounce. And the signal level that you would be receiving would be something like minus 205 dBm, a number that rolls off the tongue very easily. You look at that mathematically, it's crazy. And we came to the conclusion that minus 205 dBm was something like one photon per second. We said to ourselves, hey, this is a nice theoretical experiment, but it's not real. Guess what? It has become real. In the case of the European Southern Observatory in La Salina, Chile, roughly 1 year ago, they decided to listen to Halley's Comet. Everybody calls it Halley, Halley, Halley. The family name is Halley. But Halley's Comet is now at the aperhelion, in other words, the furthest distance it is from the sun. Halley's Comet, by the way, is blacker than a piece of coal, and it's way out beyond Pluto. They aimed their great big super telescope at it, processed the picture for, I think, something like a million seconds. They were getting 1.5 photons per second into this huge telescope, and they gathered that data for a long enough period of time to make a picture of Halley's Comet at its aperhelion, the furthest it gets from the sun. The dimmest picture that has ever been made to date. What is it now? The 29th magnitude was the image. The dimmest picture that has ever been made. So, one photon per second being gathered by that telescope. When Tom Williams and I made that theoretical study as a joke, we were sending a bunch of emails back and forth one day. How weak can you really detect the signal? Can I do moon bounce with a dipole? And with the right digital code, the answer was yes. Is it practical? Well, it's a data rate of, you know, 1 bit per hour or 1 bit per day. Not very practical. But yes, it can be done. And these guys were taking a picture of Halley's Comet, did it. They counted photons. Now, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, and you go from radio to microwave to millimeter wave to far infrared to near infrared, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, and smaller wavelengths, each photon at the higher frequency contains more energy. So our photon down at 432 megacycles doing this moon bounce experiment, each photon's got very little energy. But in theory, you can build a receiver that'll listen to one photon per second. It's not out of the question. K2KEY, listening to really weak signals. K2IIW.
Okay, this is KEY. All right, now these photons. In other words, you say the photons. When the photon, in other words, actually we are looking at photons. When in a picture tube. Okay, here's a good idea. Optical fluorescence. there because optical fluorescence, we actually are seeing an electron strike the base of this painted piece of glass. I guess that's a form of a photon display. Am I correct? Over.
Absolutely. The gun assembly of your cathode ray tube has taken those electrons, accelerated them to near the speed of light at a particular direction of your yoke assembly that is deflecting them. They come flying across the tube. They strike the phosphor inside that hard vacuum. They strike the phosphor, and the deceleration of that electron striking that phosphor creates a kind of local ionization that makes it emit a number of photons, and those photons are at a high enough frequency that you and I would call white light, if it's a white phosphor, and the white light emitted by that phosphor comes flying through the glass.